This past week, my wife and I were watching the news, and she came in and said, "Honey, come on in. I think you'll want to watch this." I was in my office, and our TV is in the kitchen area. And it was President Bush and Tony Blair, Prime Minister of England, and a news conference was going on regarding the situation in Iraq. And you may have heard, or maybe you've heard about it, but Tony Blair is going to be going to the Middle East and making efforts towards solving some of the problems there, using what influence he has, dealing with some of the issues. And the conference, the news conference went on for quite a while, as you know, and you're the newspaper reporters out here, right? The journalists. And so they're up here, President Bush and Tony Blair, and they shoot questions at you, shoot questions to you, Iraq and the Middle East. And as I was watching it, as they were answering questions that were thrown at them, and they're not always easy. Sometimes they're very direct, pointed questions, like to President Bush, why haven't you admitted your mistakes, and what are you going to do differently? And it's interesting to watch how these are conducted and how they're answered. But as I was watching this go on, and we're all sick and tired of what's happening in Iraq, we hate it every day when this many more American soldiers and civilians, or anybody for that matter, are being killed over there. We hate it, we want it to be over with, and we'd like to see us, when possible, get out of there. But I made this comment to Leanne as I just sat back and watched. Here's President Bush representing America. And we know who America is in prophecy, don't we? Manasseh, son of Abraham, descendants of Abraham, his son Isaac, his son Jacob, his son Joseph, Joseph's sons Ephraim and Manasseh. So here's President Bush representing America, Manasseh. Here's Tony Blair. We know who Ephraim is, representing that commonwealth of nations that was predicted in the Bible, America, the great nation, the powerful nation. And here they are, and they're up there sticking together and supporting one another against all adversaries. And even the issue came up, well, how can we really solve the problems in Iraq and the Middle East without addressing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that is going on? And we also know, don't we, that Israel still exists as a nation because of America and Britain's support, of our unflinching support of Israel. Because I think we all understand that if America, President Bush were to say, well, we're no longer going to supply Israel with any weapons, any money, or any political support, they're on their own. I think you all know what would happen, don't you? All hell would break loose. And so they hold off because they know America and Britain are powerful nations who stick together and are still supporting the Jewish nation. I'd like today to take us through a little bit of ancient history and remind you of who the peoples are of the Middle East. What I'm going to focus on are who are the Arabs? Who are the Palestinians? Who are these Middle Eastern people? Why is there such conflict? How will it end? And how will that affect us? Should you care? Should you be interested? How can something so far away be of concern? Well, I think we all know after 2001, 9/11, that it can come to our shores. We could be fighting Islamic terrorists right here in our own cities in America. Some of the dangers that we see, as I'm going to point out as we go through, that these things are spreading all over the world. But first of all, as this may be a reminder for some of you, a good review, and yet I think we're getting closer. When we look at the prophecies, and we're going to look at a few of those at the end of the sermon of what Jesus himself said. You know, Jesus, what did Jesus tell us to do? Jesus himself, a lot of things we need to look at in the world prophetically. But Jesus himself focused his attention on Jerusalem and Israel and the Middle East. He specifically said, watch, and when you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, then flee. So that's where God told us to focus our attention specifically. But we're going to begin first in the book of Genesis. We're going to get an overview today of why the conflict exists and who the people are over there, and why they hate the Jews and now Americans and the British. Genesis chapter 16. Genesis chapter 16, and we will read together here, verses 1 through 12, and it'll probably begin to jog your memory if it's been a while since you've read some of these verses. Genesis 16, verse 1. Now Sarai and Abram's wife, and these are their names before God changed it to Abraham and Sarah. Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, see now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid, and perhaps I shall obtain children by her. Or as some translations say, maybe I can have a family, children in a family, through my handmaid. And it's hard for us to grasp and understand this, but this was more of a custom at the time. And having children was critically, vitally important. And so if the wife was barren, they would do this occasionally. And perhaps I can obtain children, she said. They'll be my children through Hagar. And Abraham heeded the voice of Sarah. We always laugh at that. It doesn't say, you know, maybe he did, but it doesn't say. He may have said, oh no, Sarah, you know, I really don't want to do that. I shouldn't do that. Remember, God promised us 10 years ago, and that's how far back it was. 10 years ago, remember when God told us that he would bless us with descendants, you and me? So sometimes you have to read through the lines and maybe try to imagine conversations going on at the time. But anyway, regardless of what happened, Abraham finally agreed to do that. And then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. That was a custom. After Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, so they'd already been there 10 years waiting, and you can be sure they had been trying to have children. Sarai had been trying to get pregnant, knowing that God said that he would bless them with children. 10 years have gone by. And she became impatient and lost faith. And so he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. So Hagar lost respect for Sarah. And verse 5 says, Sarai said to Abram, my wrong be upon you. I made a mistake, but it's your fault. I gave my maid into your embrace. And when she saw that she has conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judged between you and me. And that was an expression of anger at the time. The Lord's judged between you and me. So Sarah's a little upset here, because her handmaid no longer has respect for her. And Abram said to Sarai, indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do to her as you please. Sarah, you're the one who told me to go into her. And now you got a problem. You do what you need to do. And so what did Sarah do? She dealt harshly with Hagar. So much so that Hagar ran away, pregnant, and fled. And verse 7, the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And the angel said, Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? That kind of gauging a conversation. I mean, the angel obviously knew. And she said, I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai. And so the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hand. You go back. Like Dan was saying, you have to let God guide our paths, right? And so she was heading for the wilderness to get away from an angry Sarai, who's over her. In verse 10, the angel of the Lord said to her, this is to Hagar, I will multiply your descendants exceedingly so that they shall not be counted for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, which means God hears, because the Lord has heard your affliction. And notice verse 12 now about Ishmael, a prophecy about Ishmael. God, who knows the DNA from the moment of conception and what the personality and nature of children and babies would be, God says here in verse 12 through this angel, he shall be a wild man. Now the NIV and certain other translations put it this way. He shall be a wild donkey of a man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in, King James here says, in the presence of his brethren, but properly translated, more accurately translated from the NIV and others, he shall dwell in hostility toward all his brethren. So this would be the nature of Ishmael and his descendants. Interesting how far back these things go. And Abram, in verse 16, was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. So he would have been 85 when Ishmael was conceived, and he was 75 when God made the promise to him to give him children through Sarah. Let's go on to chapter 17. Chapter 17, well, we're right here. Pick it up, next chapter, verses 1 through 5. When Abram was 99 years old, so time is moving on now, a few more years, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. And then Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, which means a father of many nations. For I have made you a father of many nations. Now drop down to verse 15, verses 15 through 20. Then God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. Sarah means princess. And I will bless her, and I will also give you a son by her, and then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall be from her. And then Abraham fell on his face and laughed. Because remember, he's 99 years old when he was told she's going to get pregnant, and a year later, and Abraham was 100 years old, if this happened, which it did, he was going to have a baby through Sarah. He was 100, she would have been 90. He fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abraham said to God, notice what he said. God, let's just forget about that. You know, I've got a son, Ishmael. And what he's saying here in verse 18, God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. Just bless Ishmael and give me many more children and descendants through him. Because I'm 100 and Sarah's 90 already. And so, you know, thankfully, Abraham didn't get his way. God could have said, okay, Abraham, if that's what you want, I won't cause Sarai to be, become pregnant, and we'll just work with Ishmael and his descendants. God goes on, and what he said in verse 19, God said, no, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his descendants after him. That's why you and I sit here today in the most blessed country on earth. Notice verse 20. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. I know you love your son Ishmael. And Abraham was very close to Ishmael. He did love him, wanted the best for him. And he said, I've heard your prayers for Ishmael, and I have blessed him, and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly, and shall beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. So not only do we need to remember then that God, through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob — Jacob's name was changed to Israel, which means prevailer with God — so Jacob, or Israel, had 12 sons, and we all know the Israelites. The Israelites, the Jews, were one of the tribes of the Israelites, Judah. And Joseph then, one of the 12 also, then his had Manasseh and Ephraim, and Israel, Jacob, whose name was Israel, laid his hands on them, remember, and said, let my name, Israel, be named on Manasseh and Ephraim. But we also need to remember this, and sometimes I forget it, I'm not thinking about it, that God also promised Abraham that his son Ishmael would also have 12 sons, and they would become great nations. They exist today in the Middle East. Let's go to chapter 21. Chapter 21. Read with me now verses 1 through 13. We're going to take a look a little bit later at what's going on over there and who those peoples are and why they can't get along. Genesis 21, beginning in verse 1. The Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abram a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. That's why we need to never give up, never lose faith or hope, even when physically it doesn't look like things can work out for us. You know, we can't, as Dan said, you learn to walk by faith, not by the physical circumstances. Because they were too old to have children. But it happened at the set time which God had spoken. And Abram called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac, which means laughter. Because they had laughed about it, and then maybe because of the joy finally when he was born, that there was that son after all, that Sarah must have been, as you can imagine, giddy with happiness that finally she was. It was very important, even more so back then, to be able to have a child when you were married, than even much more than today. And Abram in verse 3 says, called the name of his son who was born Isaac, and then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. And now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made me laugh, so that all who hear will laugh with me. And she also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Wow. At 90 years old. Remember, Sarah was a beautiful woman even at that age. Well preserved, still looking very nice, still able to do this. For I have borne him a son in his old age. So the child grew and was weaned. And Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. See, there's still this conflict, right, between Sarah and Hagar and Ishmael. You know, Hagar, you know, must have wanted the best for her son. Look, Ishmael is now what? What was he, 10, 12 years old by the time Isaac was born? And so you can put yourself even in Hagar's position. Here's the man who fathered Ishmael, who loved him dearly, and now comes along this new baby, Isaac. And here are these two women and the conflict, and this is where it began, way back then. So the child grew and was weaned. In verse 9, Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing, or saw her laughing, it says in the margin, scoffing, probably laughing in a scoffing way. And therefore she said to Abraham, that is, Sarah is saying, get rid of this woman. You get her out of here, Abraham. Cast this bondwoman and her son away. For the son of this bondwoman shall not be the heir with my son, Isaac. So they were human beings, just like you and me. And they had human emotions and human feelings, human passions, human goals and desires. And the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. That is, because he loved Ishmael. And he didn't want to do that. But God said to Abraham, in verse 12, do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. For whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. In other words, my covenant, my promise, my blessings that I have given to you shall be through Isaac and his descendants. Those birthright promises. And notice what he adds, though, what God adds in verse 13. Yet I will also make a nation of the son of the bondwoman because he is your seed, because he is your descendant, because he is your son. For that reason, Abraham, I will also bless him. And he's going to have 12 sons, too. Well, many of you know that story. It's kind of a review. Let's go over to chapter 25. Chapter 25, and read verses 12 through 18. A little bit more then about where the people of the Middle East came from. Now, this is the genealogy of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maidservant, bore to Abraham. Now, these were the names of the sons of Ishmael, by their names according to their generations. The firstborn of Ishmael, Naboth, and then Kedar, Adbeel, Mibsam, Mishma, Duma, Masa, Hadar, Tema, Jeter, Naphish, Kedema. These were the sons of Ishmael, and these were their names by their towns and their settlements. 12 princes according to their nations. These were the years of the life of Ishmael, 137. God gave him a long life, didn't he? 137 years old. And he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. They, referring to his sons and descendants, dwelt from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt as you go toward Assyria. And that is the area that is known as the Arabian Peninsula. And we have all seen all those old movies of the Arabs and the Arabians on their camels and their horses. And that's where Ishmael's descendants settled. And they were divided in small tribes and fought among themselves, just like the Israelite tribes fought among themselves. So did Ishmael's sons and their descendants as nomadic tribes in the desert. And they weren't united and they weren't organized and they weren't a powerful nation and for a long, long time. But just scattered as a divided warring people in the deserts of that area. And you all know a little bit of history. Who was it that came along finally and united the Arabs? Anybody remember the name? Muhammad. Yeah. It was Muhammad, who was a very religious man, came along. Remember, it was about 600 AD. He was a very strong religious leader. And it was through his fiery zeal, powerful personality, and leadership, who finally united the Arabs, or the descendants of Ishmael. He was called a prophet. Muhammad is called a prophet because, you know, he said he received revelations from Allah. I guess they put the proper pronunciation as an Allah, but they put the pronunciation on the second syllable, Allah, which means their God, God, that he supposedly received revelations from God, wrote them down. They were preserved in the Quran, so we all know that their holy book is the Quran, or their Bible. We call it our Bible. They call it their Quran or holy book. Their faith that Muhammad, as he brought about, their faith began to be called what? Islam. Islam. That means in their language, Islam just means submission to God. So we're submissive to God. We're Islamic. And they're called what? Muslims. And Muslim just means one who is submissive, one who submits. So that's what Islam and Muslim mean, those terms. And that is the Muslim religion. And they are Muslims. It's like we belong to Christianity and we are Christians. They belong to the religion called Islam, and they are Muslims. And Muslims believe that the Quran, their Bible, supersedes this Bible because it was given later, right? The Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament, and the New Testament scriptures were given right there in the, you know, beginning of the first century A.D., time of Christ and the apostles, and the other revelations of God given to the prophets were even much prior to that. So the Muslims then believe that the revelations that were given to Muhammad supersede our later revelations from God. There's a lot to learn and understand about what is going on over there. But as a result of Muhammad's leadership and those that he appointed and used, Islam, they came together. Those descendants of Ishmael came together and became a powerful people. They began to grow very rapidly. They're strong at proselyting, very strong proselyting people. Our religion is the only true religion. And they began powerfully to proselyte and even conquer other nations and peoples around them. And they spread around the world within about 500 years. And I think most of you know that today, over 50 countries in the world are predominantly Muslims. You know, there are over a billion Christians, Catholics and Protestants in the world, other Christians. But there are over 1 billion Muslims in the world. So you see these two powerful religions clashing once again, right, beginning to happen here. So just a reminder, the Bible has a great deal to say about the Middle East and who the people are over there. Now, we need to understand that the majority of Muslims around the world are not Arabs, which means they're not all descendants of Ishmael. What the Arabs did was begin to take their zeal and their religion to many other nations and to spread that faith powerfully. For instance, Indonesia, which is just north of Australia. Here's Australia, a pretty big place. We've lived there. And not very far north, very nearby is Indonesia. Over 150 million Muslims live right up there. What's going to happen in the end time? 150 million of them live right north of Australia. There are other non-Arab nations, and so when we say Arab, we're talking about Ishmael's descendants who dwelt in the Arabian Peninsula. But this faith or religion was spread to many other nations that were not non-Arab. Some of them, for instance, are Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Turkey, and even Iran. They're not direct descendants of Ishmael, but of others in the Bible. And I think we all are aware that even India, China, and the Soviet Union have a large Muslim population, and we read about the conflicts that go on within them between their religions as well, and the Muslims as well. But what else, where else has Islam spread, not only to those countries? What about Europe? What about the countries of Europe and the conflicts going on there? What about Britain? What about the United States? So, and I've been reading several books on the subject just to get different perspectives on it. But even though there are differences and conflicts among themselves, you know, like in Iraq, the Sunnis and the Shiites, and all what that's over is when Muhammad died, he didn't appoint a successor. And he had a son-in-law that many of his followers felt that it should at least be a relative of Muhammad who should be the successor after Muhammad died. Others disagreed and wanted a more powerful leader than the son-in-law. And they split over that. And so you have, just like among Christian denominations, you have the disagreements over this or that, and they split. And yet they still call themselves Christian. So it's the same thing over there right now. They'll fight and kill each other. But they're all looking forward to the coming of their Messiah and their prophecies of their book, the Quran. And they're also looking for a powerful, strong leader, a divine leader, to unite them once again, to unite all of the Arab nations all over the world, especially in the Middle East, but all over the world, so that they can once again be united and be stronger. And their goal and hope and dream, at least of many, maybe not the average, I'm not saying of the average Muslim, but those who read their holy book and have ambitions, is for Islam to once again rule the world. Let's go to Psalm 83 in the Bible. Psalm chapter 83 is a prophetic psalm that mentions a lot of the various nations of the Middle East and even up into Europe, and gives us an idea of what's going to happen. Psalm 83. It's an end-time prophecy here. This was actually covered in some detail back in the Bible reading program back in September of 2005. But read it with me, verses 1 through 8. Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace. Do not be still, O God, for behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. And what is it that the leader of Iran and some of the other countries around Israel have said? I mean, even just recently, not that long ago. I mean, he came out in one of his speeches and said, our goal is to destroy Israel as a nation, to wipe out, to kill every Jew. I think we all know that. They hate those people. And notice verse 5. They have consulted together with one consent, one heart. They form a confederacy against you. So this is prophetic. You know, God is telling us, and there are other scriptures on this, that what is going to begin to happen in order to finally destroy the Jews and the Jewish state and wipe them out. And what they're going to have to do before they can do that is wipe us out. They've got to take us out of the picture, at least. They've got to take Ephraim and Manasseh, America and Britain, out of the picture so we can't stop them from doing that. But that's their goal. This animosity and this hatred goes way back. Notice what it says here in verse 6. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites. Now, remember, some of you remember, but who are the Edomites? Who does Edom, the Edomites, descend from? Remember, one of the other descendants, there was Abraham, there was Isaac, and then there was Jacob, and they had twins. Yeah, Esau, right, Esau, the Turks, primarily the Turks today. Let me read just a little bit about this. The descendants of Esau, also called Edom in the Bible, in Genesis 25:30, identifies Edom. They're the descendants of Esau, one of Jacob's sons. It says the descendants of Esau intermarried with Ishmael's descendants, and their bitterness and resentment against Jacob's descendants intensified through the centuries. So the descendants of Esau intermarried with the descendants of Ishmael. In other words, they're all kind of related some ways, aren't they? Distant cousins and relatives. But they were bitter, just like the bitterness that existed between Hagar and Sarah. Esau's grandson, Amalek, so one of Esau's descendants, when it was actually a grandson, was called Amalek, Genesis 36:12. Amalek was the father of the Amalekites. We've all heard that. The Amalekites became bitter foes of the descendants of Jacob, or the 12 tribes of Israel. Bible scholars believe that many of today's Palestinians are largely the descendants of the Amalekites, and who have always hated the Jews and always wanted to destroy them. In other words, the anger, the hostility, goes all the way, it's passed on from parents to children, generation after generation, and it intensifies. And sometimes they don't even know why, although they all claim Abraham as a father, and they do know that. They all know they go back to Abraham. It's interesting that even today, maybe I'm sure you've heard this as well. Do you know what the Israeli battle cry is of the Israeli army? You know, like we've got a one, remember the Alamo, you know, kind of thing. Any of you remember what the Israeli army's battle cry is? Somebody might remember.
Remember the Amalekites.
Exactly. Remember the Amalekites. Because they were always, even coming out of Egypt, you know, they would wait and attack them from the rear. Remember the Amalekites. And so let's read on here. The tents of Edom, the descendants of Turkey, of Esau, many of them whom are is Turkey predominantly today, and the Ishmaelites, or the Arabs, and Moab, and we'll see Ammon mentioned in verse 7, Moab and Ammon, we know who those are today, it's the Jordanians, and Hagarites, well, who are the Hagarites, but descendants of Hagar, they would be descendants, Ishmaelites. Gebal, verse 7, many of the commentaries say that's a region, a mountainous region in Edom, or in Turkey, and then Ammon, associated with Moab. And then Amalek, so we've already read who Amalek is, the grandson of Esau, the Amalekites, who've hated the descendants of Jacob, Israel, always attacked them. Remember, because you remember what happened between, it was between Jacob and Esau, wasn't it, that it happened, that Esau sold his birthright. Remember, he was the firstborn. But he got real hungry and sold his birthright to Jacob, remember? And then after that, he regretted that, and he's hated Jacob and his descendants ever since and been very bitter over that. Philistia, many of the commentaries say these would be what we would say today, Palestinians, with the inhabitants of Tyre. Where's Tyre? What country would that represent today? Lebanon, right? That's where Tyre is, Lebanon. Look what's going on there. Hezbollah trying to overthrow the Lebanese government, so Lebanon becomes a stronghold of terrorists from the north to destroy Israel from the north if they can. Aha, verse 8. Assyria has also joined them. So here you've got these Arabs and also others who are not necessarily Arabs or descendants of Ishmael, but who are of the Islam religion and who are Muslims. And they're all going to begin to work together and form a confederation, it says. The sole purpose is because of their hatred and anger toward Israel. And what do they join with? Assyria. We all remember. You can study this on your own if you want to. But this would be Germany has joined with them. Germany, World War I. Germany, World War II. They're a strong people. They are a people who hate disorder and confusion. Leanne and I have been there. Maybe many of you have too. They like order. They like law. They are a strong, dominant people, and they will once again be in the European Union is developing a powerful force leading the United States of Europe. So Syria will join with them eventually, and that's not happened right now. And it says they have helped the children of Lot. Go with me to Daniel chapter 11. We all know that chapter. Let's just review that one very quickly, and then I'll begin to wrap it up here. Daniel chapter 11. Now, Daniel chapter 11 takes place sometime after the fulfillment of what we've just read. This confederation of Arab and Muslim nations working together, and then finally, even where they get the support of Europe joining with them, and they go against Israel. They go against the Holy Land. Notice Daniel 11, verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. So where are we now? Right now we're seeing events in the Middle East that will, the Bible indicates, lead towards some kind of a peaceful settlement eventually. You know, Isaiah and other prophets mention the time when people will be saying, peace, peace. But then he adds, but there is no peace. So some kind of a peaceful settlement will probably be worked out. We'll see who is involved in that, bringing that about. But it's going to be deceptive. It's going to be misleading. Will not be permanent. And then the Jews will be double-crossed because their goal is to kill them and wipe them out as a people. And so at the time of the end, after this confederation has taken place and formed, and what looks like may happen here is that the king of the south, you know, and I know there are all kinds of ideas out there and in the internet and what you call it. Some say Hawaii is the king of the south or the north. I mean, I've read everything. Australia is this and that. But history shows that the resurrection of the beast power at the end time has always been in Europe. That's where the beast power is going to come from. And the king of the south from there is what's Middle East is going on there all about. So there's going to be enough of a union among the Arabs and the Muslim nations that they will form a confederation, work together closely with Assyria for a while, the United States of Europe. But then what is this telling us may happen? That somewhere along the line, maybe a leader of the king of the south gets a little bit cocky and overly confident? Something like that, maybe? Is that what it's telling us? Because the confederation, they've been working together. And then all of a sudden, they turn and think, well, we're pretty organized now and pretty powerful. Maybe they've even got the atomic bomb by then. Iran wants it. Who knows what will happen? And they feel confident. Now, either it's a physical attack, and that seems to indicate that, or some have speculated because they possess still the greatest reserves of oil, and Europe is 85% dependent on oil imports from the Middle East, far more than we are even in America. And some have speculated, well, maybe they use the oil that they somehow blackmail the European Union to get their way, and it backfires on them. So either physically they try to attack them for some reason, or else maybe they begin to threaten the survival of Europe through oil, gas, the economy, that type of thing. But we see what happens is the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, blitzkrieg, right? With chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, they'll surround that whole area. And he will enter the countries and overwhelm them and pass through. And he will enter the glorious land or the holy land. And many countries will be overthrown. So Israel, the Jewish state, will be conquered, subdued, taken over. You and I know that's coming eventually. All of these things, as I watch the news and I see what's happening, and I'm trying to do, and which I hope you are as well, trying to understand, okay, God, how long is it going to take? Where are we now in the fulfillment of these many prophecies? Verse 41, he'll enter the glorious land, the king of the north will. Many countries will be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, and they probably escape because they are allied with the king of the north. These shall escape out of his hand, Edom and Moab. So that's Jordan. And the prominent people, or the NIV says, the leaders of Ammon. So looks like Jordan will be smart enough to know where they need to maintain their loyalty. And maybe, politics, remaining peaceful as possible with their Arab neighbors and those in the Middle East, and yet recognizing the power of Europe, they escape. And he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, that is the king of the north, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Now, is this telling us that before this is all done, we may see Egypt arise as a more powerful player in the Middle East? That's possible, isn't it? The land of Egypt shall not escape. Will the king of the south come from Egypt? Well, those are questions to ask. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, that is the king of the north, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and also the Libyans and Ethiopians, and so that's North Africa, shall follow at his heels or be subdued. So, you know, the Bible does tell us ahead of time all the things that are going on, the politics that are beginning to happen. And so what we'll do, brethren, let's just close with one scripture from Jesus Christ. Let's go to Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21. I've given this because I hope, brethren, that you are watching and doing what Jesus said to do and understanding the importance of what is going on. Luke chapter 21. Turn there with me. And we'll finish by beginning here reading in verse 20. Luke chapter 21, verse 20. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. This is Jesus Christ speaking. And he had been asked by his disciples, when is it going to come to an end? What'll be the end of the age, the end of this time, the fulfillment of all these prophecies? And he's answering, he's explaining. That's why we need to be doing what Jesus said. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. When will the double cross come? When will the peace come that maybe lulls them into a state of thinking everything's going to be okay over there? When and how will America be brought down or removed so that the king of the north, the United States of Europe, is not afraid or is able to move into that area of the world and just take over the Holy Land and the glorious land? When will we be brought down? How? See, this is what you and I know and care about. We're concerned. Let those in Judea flee to the mountains. So if any of God's people who understand these things are there, they better get out fast. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter into her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant, to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword, war, and be led away captive, those who are alive, into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles have been fulfilled. And that's 3.5 years That's a time of the Great Tribulation. But thank God that we have Jesus Christ, who's alive today. We understand these things, but we don't understand all the details. We may not have everything perfectly correct, but brethren, it's happening. The overall thing that we know is coming to pass is happening. And let's close with verses 34 through 36. What should you and I be doing? Why should we care? Why should we be interested in the Middle East and watching Jerusalem, praying for our president? You know, I know a lot of people hate George Bush, but what if God is using him to bring about these things? And people, oh, he just needs to get out. But what if God has other plans? What if God is using George Bush and Tony Blair to stick together, to delay it a little bit longer? So we need to just pray, Father, your will be done. Read together, take heed to yourselves, Jesus said, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, the cares of this life, and that that day come upon you unexpectedly, for it will come as a snare on those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. And therefore the well-known verse, I think most of us could quote this in my memory, Luke 21:36, where Jesus said, watch therefore and pray always. Watch and pray. Stay close to God. That's what Jesus is saying. Don't lose your focus. Go on with your lives. Have goals. Work hard. Do the things that are important in our life. Yes, that's what we're supposed to do. But keep your eyes on Jerusalem and the Middle East. Watch and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of God. Brethren, just wanted to remind you that the Bible has a lot to say about the Middle East and who those people are. And we understand why and how far back it goes, the animosity and the hatred that is there, and that it will only be solved at the return of Jesus Christ.